The Anachronistic Holiday Special. Disclaimer: all of the following is not canon, except for the parts that are. What choice do I regret most? You know, when I was alive, I spend a lot of time thinking about choices. Now that I'm on the other side of this mortal coil, I wonder which choice it was that secured this fate for me. Sorry, I'm used to telling these stories to someone who lived them. Abigail already knew the gist. She traveled with me for a long time before these post-mortem metaphysical chats started happening. But it occurs to me that, unlike her, you might not actually know my life story, ironically as that sounds. If you do, though, I ask that you bear with me, because you've asked me a very complicated question, and the answer requires context. After all, I'm a very specific version of Neil. The sum of all the choices I made and all the stories I told. But if there was one choice that truly doomed me, I think that choice should be my biggest regret, right? Of course, it's this kind of thinking that got me killed in the first place. Misguided frustration tells me that this choice was all the way back in high school when I first asked Abigail out. But in the journey that led me here, I saw a Neil without an Abigail, and things didn't exactly end any better for him. So, next up is a bus I once chose to take. If I had just splurged for an Uber that night, I'd have lived a much longer, much more normal life, I think. But I couldn't have known that bus ride would have thrown me non-consensually into a career of time-space maintenance, so it wasn't really a choice at all, was it? It was circumstance. Destiny, if you will. Then there was taking her with me. Abigail, I mean, when we first met up again. But while it was certainly the start of my downfall, I can't bring myself to regret the choice itself. There's more choices I regret, of course. There are crimes I committed, victims I've left behind, but I'd consider those choices more a result of my circumstances rather than a cause, so I think it must have been a job before Abigail and I even traveled together. The December before, in fact. It was the last time I saw my parents, my hometown, and also, I think, where I chose this destiny. It all started with a trip through Indiana. And the state really does come up a lot in my stories, doesn't it? I imagine it would come up a lot in yours, too. It's like Tatooine and Star Wars. It's supposed to be the middle of nowhere, but I guess being the main character's birthplace gives it a special treatment, eh? I was born in Indiana. I died there. And as I traveled from one coast to another for my job, the place simply kept being in the way. That was the case this time, too. I was intending to pass through on my way to a bigger job somewhere westward, but between me and that job stood my hometown. And my parents. I'd moved away a long time ago, long before my life got weird. It's not that I didn't miss them, and until I got the job, I called them regularly, but it had been a year and a half since then. I think part of what stopped me from reaching out was how, exactly, I would explain it to them. They were always encouraging me to build a career with some company that would take care of me. to put that expensive college degree to work. My generation was barred from that life even before I had to leave traditional employment behind for conscripted universe maintenance. I didn't know where I would even begin explaining it to them, why I'd never be able to settle down or own a house or do any of those things they just expected of life. Between that and simply being so wiped from traveling nonstop for the job, I found it hard to maintain a relationship with them. It wasn't just them either. All my relationships fell by the wayside. During every drive, a face would come to mind. I promised to call them when I finally had a minute to breathe, but those minutes never came. I was always so busy, so tired, and so ashamed of how it would look to come back out of the blue after spending so long being quiet. But I still cared, even though I'm sure many thought I didn't. Too tired to do is not too tired to care. But here, I had an opportunity. Between me and the direction my job pulled, to visit my hometown. And while the job never let me stand still for long, job be damned, I'd at least spend a day with my family. This story starts before I knocked on their door, though. It starts in the Starbucks down the street. If I was going to see them again, I needed to calm my nerves. And by that, I mean I needed to anxiously ruminate on the near future while sipping 18 ounces of caffeine and sugar. At the counter, a girl about my age with expertly sculpted eyeliner waited for me to order. As is my tradition, I thought about one of their many, many seasonal items, knowing deep down inside that I'd order none of them and pick my usual instead. But as I thought about my order, I caught her looking at me. I assumed she wanted me to hurry up, or at least had some pressure to greet every customer who made eye contact. But when I looked to her, she quickly snapped away. First thought, was she checking me out? Second thought, of course she wasn't. I'd been living in my car for a year and looked the part. Third thought, even if she was, what would I even say? I was only going to be in town for a day at most. But as I made my order, and then as I sipped my drink, she kept looking at me. And I kept looking at her, and back. And forth, and back again, and each time I caught her staring, my brain swerved from its intended mission of anxious parent rumination into that thought of, what if? But then I left. I wasn't about to be that creepy customer who hits on the barista, especially considering I was probably just overthinking things. But when I put my hand on the door, I heard her say,
"See you next time."
And I froze for just a moment, finally convincing myself that it was more than what my brain told me. How I'd meant to respond was,
"I'd love to see you again, but unfortunately I'm just passing through."
And instead, what my mouth said was,
"Probably not."
I was in the car driving to my parents' place by the time I realized what I'd actually said and how it must have sounded. The extra caffeine already had my hands shaking while I mentally relived my dumb asshole words in slow motion. And thus, I was traveling from an anxiety-filled present to an anxiety-filled future, through the stomping grounds of my anxiety-filled past. Between that and an ever-growing headache, I tried to blame on the caffeine and stress. I pushed that interaction from my mind. It was someone I didn't know, after all. Someone who I'd probably never see again, right? But these little interactions, these failed opportunities, they had their hooks in me just as much as any neglected past. I drove by the cul-de-sac where I used to play with the neighbors as a kid, a 10-minute walk from my house, and then the intersection where my elementary school bus would pick us up and let us out. I couldn't even remember why I had stopped hanging out with them. Even that long ago, I had neglected relationships. Anyway, my tour through the neighborhood ended at my parents' driveway. I'm not sure I ever really understood our money situation growing up. There were lean times and times of plenty, like with everyone, I think. But just the fact that we had a house is a level of privilege most of the people I've been close to didn't have. The family of Hal, my best friend through high school, owned a house, but had to rent the land it was built on in some weird lopsided deal. I vaguely remembered one of the neighborhood girls in that cul-de-sac living with her grandparents because her parents didn't make enough to take care of her. All this is to say, I was lucky for the situation I was raised in. I was lucky for the parents I had. And of all my misfortunes in love and money and life, I know, in a not insignificant way, it was offset by having parents who took care of me as a child and who, when they saw my car drive up, immediately came out to embrace me. When I crossed the threshold into my childhood home, a wave of familiar but unplaceable smells met me. I expected a bombardment of questions about where I'd been, what I'd been doing, and why I hadn't called, but the only one that came was,
"Should I make you some coffee?"
No, thanks,
I told my dad. That Starbucks seemed to be hitting a lot harder than one drink should, after all. I followed my mom into the living room and passed by the frosty landscape depicted on their December calendar. They kept almost no lights on, and the cool winter sun barely cast light into the living room. They'd reupholstered the couch since last time I'd been there. Wasn't sure I'd liked it, but the armchairs were still as plush as I remembered. I sank down into one and felt my spine pop in relief to finally be sitting in something so comfortable after so long on the road. My mom stared at me, and I didn't know what to say until my dad came in with 3 coffee mugs.
"Yeah, Dad, really, you didn't have to,"
I said while he placed one on the lamp table next to me. I picked up the coffee anyways and stared into my reflection, only to be met by a massive wave of drowsiness. I didn't know how I could be so over-caffeinated and yet so tired. And then I realized, I don't know if you know this already, but when there's a problem with the universe, when the past blends into the present or the future, or when the boundary between worlds crosses, most people rationalize it away. But people like me, people whose job it was to fix that sort of thing, we hold both truths in our head, and it hurts. It creates a headache. And no sooner had I realized that my caffeine headache was not, in fact, a caffeine headache than a peculiar drowsiness overtook me. And I drifted off into a sudden, uncontrolled sleep. There's a psychologist named Robin Dunbar, who is best known for theorizing the number of relationships a human brain is able to maintain with any sort of reliability. The proposed number is 150, but of course this was never meant to be a fixed figure. Nature abhors binaries and simple solutions. For starters, this number is just an average. But more than the number itself, what's interesting to me is the further breakdown of relationship data his studies showed. From intimate partners, to close friends, to best friends. The stronger a relationship is, the fewer of them the human mind seems capable of maintaining. It makes sense that there is turnover. Throughout your life, did you stay close to that girl in high school you used to tell everything to? Do you even remember her name? Or did someone else take over that function for you? The people close to me when I was young were not close to me when I died. I met new friends, and the closeness I afforded my old friends got redistributed. I don't like it, but I do think it's natural and normal. It's okay for it to be sad, but ultimately, it is the way of things. Of course, by the time I died, my problem was growing apart from old friends, but never having an opportunity to make new ones in their place. I drove all across the country, meeting people, learning their troubles, feeling their pain. Pain that was so strong it literally caused knots and tears in reality. But then I had to move on and start again. I was left with 150 friends, but no close friends, no best friends, and certainly no lovers. Only memories. When I first woke up after falling asleep, it wasn't in that same chair, in that same room, or even that same day. A muffled racket from outside stirred me, and I realized I was in my childhood bedroom, though it had been redecorated and repainted. Outside, thick chunks of snow fell, illuminated by my parents' outdoor lights. Pulling myself up, it seemed my body rose faster than my brain, which throbbed from my now fully identified quantum headache. I steadied myself and tried to understand the noise coming from the other side of the door. Voices. Lots of voices. I cautiously pushed the door open and stepped out into a full-on party in my parents' living room. I barely had time to figure out simple information like what day it was or where my parents had gone before someone from the crowd, as if watching my door, pushed through and immediately grabbed me in a hug.
"There you are. I'm so sorry I'm late,"
that someone said.
"How?"
I asked.
"Didn't anyone tell you I was coming?"
The quickest answer to give was simply no, but from the look of things, I'd been thrown into a completely different timeline, and usually in times like those, it was best to simply feign ignorance to as much as possible, while smiling and nodding to anything that seemed suspicious not to know. Hal, though, Hal I knew. He had been my best friend throughout most of school until he moved away to Chicago for college and stayed there. We kept up when I moved, but like all my relationships, when I got the job, I'd lost touch. Would my Hal have embraced me so heartily? Truthfully, I didn't know anymore. But when it came to the rest of the party, there were many faces I recognized, but hardly any names I could put to them, all people I'd grown so far away from that they might as well have been strangers.
"Looking for someone specific?"
Hal joked. He looked like he had someone in mind, but all I could do was stammer and before he cut me off with,
"We're still missing three more guests, but they said they'd be here by the end."
I mostly let Hal do the talking as we grabbed some food from the potluck. Every few minutes, someone would come up to me and give me a friendly, canned greeting like,
"Oh, Neil, it's so good to see you. How have you been?"
And I'd give a friendly, canned response like,
"I've been all right. How about you? What are you up to?"
If I was lucky, I'd get a name. But what I was really listening for was what they could tell me about myself. Who was the Neil they knew? What was this life I had suddenly found myself living? I figured it was the start of getting to the bottom of whatever transdimensional kink had summoned me here. I learned that I, too, had moved away in this timeline. That everyone was thrilled to see me, that almost everyone here had known me since fucking elementary school. I could assume, apparently, I had been popular. Some of the guests started to come more into focus for me. The neighbor kids I used to play with down the street. The friends I had before I really even knew what friendship was. A party full of frayed connections. From the living room windows, I saw another car drive up in the snow, and out stepped a woman with wiry, bleach-blonde hair, held down by a red sock hat.
"There she is,"
Hal said, leading me to the door.
"Our first latecomer."
When she stepped inside, she lit up and bashfully said,
"Hi, Neil."
At first, I am embarrassed to say, I had no idea who this was. I've only had two real girlfriends, but my first kiss was with neither of them. I was 8. The neighbor girl was 3 years older than me. She lived in the cul-de-sac down the street with all those kids I used to play with. The great benefit of suburbs, right? I always had kids my age around, but are friends of convenience really friends? Especially when you're fickle children. I was a very quiet, very weird little kid. And so, while the collective whole that was the neighbor kids couldn't get rid of me, it did mean they could unify themselves with me as a target. After all, if they all focused on ostracizing me, then they wouldn't ostracize each other. There was one exception to this alliance, though. She was the oldest of us, and as far as I could tell, didn't have any friends her age. So maybe she was nice to me because she was more mature. Or maybe she was just nice to me because she was lonely. Mostly, she just watched and read from her family's porch. And when the other kids didn't let me play basketball with them or didn't let me play with them at all, I found myself, more often than not, hanging out in her yard. I don't remember the details or what led to what. I know we started talking. I know we were in the treehouse in her yard. She wanted to play family, and I was the sick husband. Using a whole manner of plastic doctor's equipment that most people thought she probably should have grown out of, she took my temperature, measured my heartbeat, and told me I would get better soon. After all that, she kissed me on the lips. I think she was more embarrassed than I was. I was mostly just confused. I can only assume that, at our age, it was her first kiss too, although she may have been old enough to understand the context of what that meant more. A noise outside startled us out of the moment. We looked out the window and saw one of the neighbor kids running away. It apparently climbed up to spy on us. The important part of the incident, however, happened the next day. The school bus dropped us off and turned the corner when I felt one of the kids grab my shoulder, then a fist sunk into my gut. Kids may not know how to fight well, but they were smart enough to not hit me in the face, or anywhere that would be visible. I curled up in a ball on the sidewalk while they kicked at my stomach and sides. I croaked out a weak,
"Why?"
only to receive a pathetic response from the leader of their little firing squad, who said,
"You stole my girlfriend."
I didn't have all the knowledge I do now about consent, and I wasn't thinking about how fucked up it was that he thought this girl, whom he never talked to, was his girlfriend, or that he made his jealousy my problem. I didn't question how, frankly, it wasn't okay for me to have been kissed in the first place. None of us did. kids our age weren't taught anything about relationships or consent. And that means we were taught wrong. I came home crying to my parents, but refused to say what had happened. Refused to ever ride the bus again. Refused to go to that cul-de-sac. And back at the party, looking into her eyes, half the faces around me started to come to focus. And I remembered her name. Trish. The Trish in front of me, now illuminated by memory, somehow looked incredibly youthful and unbelievably worn out at the same time. And I don't mean that metaphorically. To my eyes, there really were two versions of her. One bright, cheerful, and excited to be here. The other gray, quiet, almost desperate. The incidents I fixed when I was alive. Moments where time and space crashed into one another. They were always caused by people. People with contradictory desires, or who wanted fiercely for reality to be different than what it was. So under normal circumstances, a phenomenon like this would have been an open and shut case. One Trish desperately wanted to live the life of the other, and that life had something to do with this little get-together at my parents' house. Even if I didn't know the details, I figured it was a simple enough fix. Hal took her coat and I quickly passed around the corner into the bathroom, and then, through the fabric of reality, into, well, I suppose it's similar to the place we're in now. I liked to call it the employees-only area. And inside, I could see countless threads connecting the entirety of infinity together. I dove right in, trying to find the threads which represented both versions of Trish. There are usually two ways to solve a problem like that. The best way, of course, is to talk to the person causing it. Help them through whatever they're going through, and help them move on. But I could already tell I was too close to this, and didn't want to confront whatever was causing it. I just wanted to wrap this up and get back to seeing my parents. Back to what was supposed to be my vacation. But when I found the knot and pulled apart the threads, I saw just a flash of what I was afraid of. Her life after I refused to go back to that cul-de-sac. Without me to pick on, the kids turned their attention fully to her, and with their ringleader's weird possessiveness. The years went on, her torment continued. Her parents weren't around, her grandparents were too old to help. As the kids grew up, the bullying turned to assault. So, to escape, she ran away. To escape, she turned to drugs. To escape, she'd do anything until not only was there no one around to hurt her. There was no one around to help. There was no one around at all. Now, out in the cold, she was wandering around her old neighborhood, past a childhood neighbor's house, and wondering what life would have been like if he had stuck around and not abandoned her. After cutting the thread, I threw myself out of the employees-only area and back into the guest bathroom, throwing up directly into the sink. Death brings a certain perspective. From this side of my journey, I can see that Trish's happiness was never my responsibility. Just like my happiness was never anybody else's. But it's so easy for me to fall into these what could have been traps. Child Neil made the only choice he thought he had to stay safe, but letting that relationship fade? Letting myself forget about her entirely? I couldn't shake that regret so easily. I don't think people should be replaceable or removable, no matter what Robin Dunbar says. I mean, I wasn't exactly jazzed about the direction my life had taken at that point either. And it wasn't hard for my shame-riddled brain to take. I shouldn't have let that relationship fade and make the jump to... I ruined both of our lives by being a coward. I washed down my embarrassment and rinsed off my face. But even as I steadied myself, I couldn't bring myself to leave the bathroom and face whatever version of her would be on the other side. Because even though I'd untangled those threads, the headache was still there. The job wasn't done. My spine stiffened when someone knocked at the door and a woman asked,
"Neil, are you okay?"
It wasn't Trish. It was yet another voice I didn't recognize. I dried off my face, took a breath, and opened the door. The party continued, but the faces had changed. Instead of people I'd pretty much forgotten about ages ago, now it was full of people I couldn't seem to place at all. With one immediate exception. The woman who had come to check on me was clad in a fluffy green coat, still peppered with snow from the outside, and had expertly sculpted eyeliner. But those eyes weren't looking at me. Or rather, they were looking through me towards another person behind me. Another Neil. He passed through, and they hugged.
"Thank God you're here, Em,"
other Neil said.
"I'll take that as a no. Sorry I'm late. Too many people?"
He looked grimly out to the sea of people in his parents' living room, who all seemed to go about merrily without him.
"I shouldn't have let Hal handle the invitations."
"Well, if we'd let you be in charge, it'd only be me, you, and Hal, and I've already met Hal. I wanted to meet the rest of your friends."
"Did it have to be all at once?"
"Come on, it's just one party."
She took him by the hand and pulled him away through the crowd.
"Let's get it all out of the way at once."
No one seemed to pay me any mind as the scene played out. I just hugged a corner out of the way and watched my doppelganger sheepishly make introductions while M led the conversation. It seemed this Neil matched my life closely until my move. He never left the state. He'd stayed in town his whole life, made connections, let them fade, then made new ones and kept them. People I'd simply never even met. They were new friends, but he had a lot of them, even if he didn't seem to be able to handle them all at once. I also got more information on M. He'd come into her work, she'd flirted with him, and it took a couple of visits to the cafe for him to finally get it. Everyone they talked to was surprised that not me had even started dating again after last time, but M assured all of them that she was, in fact, real. The most interesting thing to me, though, was I wasn't the only one watching them. Across the room, another M stood, still in her Starbucks uniform, watching everything play out with tired, watery eyes. The two of us weren't here living these experiences, like the situation with Trish. M's desires weren't quite so strong. This was the result of a long, simmering dissatisfaction, a desire to know that it wasn't all her fault, that she could be so much happier if one guy had given her a second look. It wasn't about me at all. I was just the latest handsome stranger who had come in and blown her off. The problem with a desire for love, though, is that it requires another person's choices and desires to align with your own. I know this all too well. You can work on your trauma as much as you want. You can have the hottest eyeliner in the state. You can even have the coolest job imaginable. But unless the other person makes the right choices, you two may never even meet. The worst part was that we wanted the same thing, though. I wondered, if I went back to that coffee shop, if I gave her that second look, could we maybe work something out? Could we build that future we both wanted, even with everything in the way? But Hal had mentioned there was still, supposedly, one more guest missing from this party. One more guest until the doorbell rang. No one showed any reaction at first. No one except the other me.
What's wrong?
His M asked.
I just realized it feels like someone's missing.
Who?
My fellow Spectre turned her attention towards the door and went pale. It was a very nuanced emotion on her face. Shock, shame, embarrassment, regret. All mashed together into the face you get when you ask someone out only to find out they're already married. The knock came again, drowning out all the noise from the party. I could feel myself being pulled away from this timeline even though I hadn't resolved anything yet. My head split, and I heard the knocking one last time, and before I knew it, I opened the door. There was no trace of the party anymore. The house became cold and silent, and an overcast sky washed out the frosty lawn in desaturated gray. On the other side of the door was a shocked woman, a familiar woman. Abigail. At the time, she looked far older than the last time I had seen her. But as far as the me you're talking to now, it had probably only been a couple of days after she'd seen me last. Her eyes were dry, the cold clearly getting to her through her puffy black hoodie. But before I could say anything, she snapped out.
What the fuck are you doing here?
The words chilled me, like she was accusing me of the sickest prank imaginable. Unlike M, she wasn't looking through me this time. She was looking at me.
Hello?
Another voice, my mother's, from behind me said.
Oh, I know you. You're Abigail, aren't you? Neil's old girlfriend.
Could my mom see how terrified Abigail looked? She certainly tried her best to hide it.
Hi, Mrs. Evergreen.
Her eyes darted from me to my mom, then back to me.
Do you have a moment to talk? It's important.
My parents led her inside where they kept almost no lights on, and my mom showed her into the living room, passing by that frosty landscape depicted on their December calendar.
Should I make you some coffee?
My dad asked. She sat in the same plush chair I had been in before this whole weird incident had started.
Yes, please.
As my dad brought in three cups, the deja vu was too powerful to not mean something. I ran to the calendar with a theory in my head and confirmed. It was the same frosty landscape, the same December calendar, but I hadn't checked the year at first. 2 years later than when I thought I had arrived. When I turned back, my mom was crying, my dad was holding her, and Abigail was staring directly at me. Slowly, she mouthed the words,
"Outside."
And, too terrified to question or disobey, I took my leave. I saw where I'd parked my truck. With no other vehicles on the whole stretch of road, I wondered how she'd gotten there. Until she came out behind me and grabbed my shoulder, looking dead into my eyes.
This isn't your job to fix, Neil,
she said.
You need to rest.
At the time, I was simply confused. Now I have more context, of course. This version of her was the Abigail after all of our adventures together. I think she'd come to tell my parents what happened to me. Someone had to. Maybe their grief had pulled me over to this time, or maybe there was already a lot of mess I left behind in this city, and I just got caught up in all of it. But at the time, I don't know, I felt intrigue, especially when things went hazy and she disappeared into her own employee's area, I now assume, to kick me out of this time I didn't belong in. But the last thing I heard from her?
Jess, please. Next time you pass through here, don't go north. Don't go to LaPel.
I don't know how she could have given a clearer warning, and yet when I came to all the way back in the Starbucks parking lot, coffee in hand, I don't think I'd learned the lesson I should have. I could have gone back into that Starbucks and apologized for my flub, to introduce myself to M and possibly form a new relationship. To hopefully make the first of those choices that could be in sync, to form a new relationship and maintain it. Hell, I could have made a call to Hal or any of my other friends I'd left behind. But instead, my dumb ass thought about Abigail. This girl I always thought would be the only relationship I ever needed. And to the place she told me specifically not to go. And I realized that if I ignored her warning, I'd definitely, at least, see her again. So I left the parking lot, and after a brief and less weird visit with my family, I continued my journey, and almost never thought about M or Trish again. Did you catch it there? The choice I regret most? Choosing to not go back into a cafe, choosing not to talk to a girl, choosing to not see where a choice might have led. All those other choices may have changed the details of my story, or might have even delayed my fate. But that change, that adjustment, could have done more than change my circumstances. It could have changed my perspective. And with my perspective, possibly all of my choices afterward. I assume you at least have some idea of what brought me here. Does it bother you that my biggest regret is pretty much just picking one girl over another, rather than everything else I've done? After being asked a question like you asked in a place like this, I'm pretty sure I know what's going on here, and I'm pretty sure you do know everything else about me. You're here to judge me, right? But I don't think you will judge me poorly. I think you will understand. Because even though we may have lived different lives, and you might have different values as a result, a different perspective, I think you can at least appreciate my conclusion that I shouldn't have tried to put the burden of all of my relationship needs on her. That I shouldn't have tried to replace all of the other people that could have been in my life with her. You have to understand. After all, on some level, we're both Neil, right? Anachronistic is written and produced by Kyle Newbridge, directed by Fable McDaniel, and edited by Cassie Pormokhtar. This special episode was funded by a small Kickstarter campaign, and oh boy, did making it take way longer than planned. Truly, it would not have been possible without all of our backers, but especially Leo Berry, Evil Flibble, Tracy Jarrett, Wesley Miller, Orson, Lauren McDaniel, Jif Pop, Darian Davis, SR Temporal Travel LLC, Kimmy Sanguine Remsnick, Tia, and Iron Oki. I'm hoping by the end of the year we'll be able to get some more anachronistic to you, at least some news. In the meantime, you can check out SeralCrows.com to see all the other projects myself, Cassie, Fable, and the rest of our collective are working on. If you like anachronistic, you may also enjoy my horror comic series, Of This Light, which is about a group of people trapped in a bizarre otherworld fighting to escape to anywhere else. I've already completed a trilogy in that world and have started releasing a new story arc, which is a fantastic jumping on point for new readers. Thank you so much for listening. See you in one of many possible futures.